Hey, welcome back, everybody. Time for our special feature we do periodically when amazing people come across our doors here that we call OC Spotlight, the one show, the only show that shows you the most incredible people in Orange County doing the most amazing things. And with us today, I'll do a bad pun on a movie that was loosely based on his life. You had me at hello. He had me at Lee Steinberg. We have Lee Steinberg in the room today, ladies and gentlemen, sharing, ready to share some of his career in sports management, being a sports agent. And more importantly, the life lessons he's learned along the way, how to make it, how to remake it, how to get back up when life throws you a curve here. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Thank you.
So I could do a talk here. You were at UCI's Applied Innovation Center. I said, we got to get this guy on the show because you not only had an amazing, dare I say, an unlikely rise to prominence from when you were a student at UC Berkeley and met some kid, we'll talk about all this, and I became a sports agent by accident to the biggest sports agent that I think in the world. And then there was the fall and where it blew up. And that would have been the end of the story for most of us. But you got back up and rebuilt the agency and now represent people like Patrick Mahomes and others. And in the talk, what struck me was you said, I never doubted I could rebuild the business. I wasn't sure I could rebuild my life. Is that a fair quote?
Yes, because my comeback is maintaining sobriety for the last 16 years and being a good father. And the challenge was to break denial and understand or understood that I had a problem and then figure out what the right path back is. So it's all about resilience. It's about life will knock you back. People can have reverses in their marital life, in their financial life.
Careers, businesses, everything. We're in a constant upheaval, constant chaos.
Their health. So inevitably, something will come back to frustrate laid plans. And the question then is, how do you get back up?
Yeah.
In the midst of darkness and despondency and depression, how do you see light at the end of the tunnel?
Right.
And how can you chart a comeback? So this book I wrote is for anyone experiencing any kind of reverse in life. And it's a game plan for
how to get back up.
Right. And live a fulfilling life.
You certainly have done that. Let's take everybody through. If they haven't read the book, I saw you give a talk years ago at the University of Michigan Club here, and I was amazed. This was, I think, your first or second book about your life story. And talk about that. How did you become a sports agent? How did you stumble into this field? There was no field called sports agents, I don't think, when you came along.
So I grew up in Los Angeles, and after a year at UCLA, went to UC Berkeley in the tumultuous 60s. And I ended
People's
up,
Park and all that.
There you go. And I ended up student body president. And the governor of California was someone named Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, exactly.
And every time we demonstrated against the war, he cracked down.
Sent in the National Guard and stuff. Yeah.
He did. And I learned everything I would later need about the art of leverage and negotiations from dealing with Governor Reagan. So I was a dorm counselor working my way through law school, and they moved the freshman football team into the dorm. And one of the students was the quarterback, Steve Bartkowski. And in 1975, he became the very first pick overall in the NFL draft with the Atlanta Falcons.
Okay, I remember that.
And he asked me to represent him. Now, there I was, brimming with legal experience.
You're not even a lawyer yet. You're in law school, and this guy, why did he come to you? You obviously got to know him through the dorm, but why would he entrust his career with you?
I think he had the sense through our relationship. So much of this is about listening skills. Can you draw out another person cut below the surface responses and understand their deepest anxieties and fears and their greatest hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
Can you put yourself in the heart and mind of another human being and see the world the way they see it? So we had bonded in the dorms, but unfortunately, there was a World Football League competing against the NFL.
That's right. I'd forgotten that, yeah.
And he got the largest rookie contract in NFL history. And I wasn't sure. There was no organized field of sports agents.
That's what I was going to say. Was there? I don't remember how.
A franchise could just hang up the phone when I called and say, we don't deal with agents. Took a couple years, so it was very embryonic at the beginning. But what I saw, Paul, was that you could take an athlete, and because of their high profile, they could trigger imitative behavior, and they could retrace their roots and go back to the high school community, set up a scholarship fund, or work with the Boys and Girls Club,
make
or church.
Make an impact, yeah.
They could lay down roots at the collegiate level and rebond with the alums from that school who could be generous mentors. And if they had a particular cause that they were passionate about, they'd establish a charitable foundation that would have the leading business figures, political figures, and community leaders on a board to execute a program.
You help them do that? Because you're an agent. You're there to negotiate a contract. Did you help act more as like a personal manager like would in Hollywood? Were you trying to cultivate a brand and an image?
Absolutely. And part of the compact was I wouldn't take a client unless they were willing to set up these programs. So that's work done. The running back from Atlanta and Tampa who has put the 220th single mother and family into the first home they'll ever own by making the down payment, or it's Patrick Mahomes with his 15 and the Mahomies, where he...
Is that what they call it, the Mahomies?
Yes.
The Mahomies, okay.
The Mahomies. But he helps kids at risk, kids who are hungry, kids who are in the hospital. And the other thing I found out was that athletes could message and trigger imitative behavior. So I had...
I never heard it described as that way, but that's exactly what it is. Imitative behavior. Right. I want to be like Mike.
Right.
Michael Jordan or whatever. I want to be like somebody.
And it's not modeling the athletic career, because very few people can really aspire to that. It's modeling a sense of caring, a sense of community. It's good value. So Lennox Lewis, the heavyweight boxing champ who I helped, cut a public service announcement that said, real men don't hit women.
Yes.
And that could do more to trigger attitudinal change in rebellious athletes than 1,000 authority figures ever could. Or Oscar De La Hoya and Steve Young, prejudice is foul play. So it was being able to do those things, having an impact in the world, the ability to target bullying or sex trafficking or domestic violence or racism or the environment and make a positive difference that kept me with it.
I'm going to push you one more on this, though, because everybody knows you were the inspiration for that movie, that famous movie, Jerry Maguire, with Tom Cruise, and where she says, you had me at hello. He was all about show me the money. That whole film was about the young guy saying, I think I deserve this. I want to be one of those players. Nobody believes in me. So if you want to work for me, you young punk, show me the money.
Show me the heart. Show me the passion. Show me that you understand your responsibility as a high-profile figure to try to put positive imagery into the world.
And I don't remember that. I grew up, we're probably of a similar age. Maybe you got a year or two of me, but I'm in my 70s here. And I remember the great athletes, the Bart Starrs, or the colorful ones, the Joe Namaths and stuff. It was still, they went through the motions of they'd show up and at the charity and stuff, but I didn't remember them running this stuff. I didn't remember them having a cause. They were there because they were good at something and they made a bunch of money at it, and they did give back to the community, but it wasn't that same sense of leaving a legacy that I see so many do today here. Am I overreacting? Or was
no,
it?
No, there was an evolution.
Yeah.
And I was able to get to the point with 64 first-round draft picks in the NFL.
64, ladies and gentlemen. You handled 64 first-round draft picks.
And eight of them were the very first pick overall in the draft.
Okay.
And then we had about 30 first-round baseball players and about five basketball players. It was a broad scope, and that gave me the ability to try to profile prospective clients and see if they had the right heart.
Because it wasn't just show me the money. You did set records. You certainly got bigger contracts for people than they probably would have ever imagined in life. That was your principal function, they would say. But you got them to think past the money.
And to think about second career.
Yes.
And what they would do later. So that I ended up with a couple players that were the first minority owners of NFL teams.
So wow.
Warwick Nunn, we just talked about, is a minority owner. Steve Young and Brent Jones put multi-billion-dollar hedge funds together.
I didn't know that.
So it was challenging the athlete early in their career that they could be the owner.
Yeah.
They could be the administrator.
Magic Johnson story.
Right.
Yeah.
So they could do that. So whether it was media or coaching or business, tried to prepare them for that. And then to focus on their long-term health.
And am I correct? We've had, through the years, we've been doing this for 15 years, we've had a lot of people that sit in that chair over there, all sorts of walks of businesses. And we've had players' representatives. I don't know why they wrote a book or they're given a talk and they came through. But I remember we had a couple NFL players' representatives here. And they said, maybe not so much the superstar players, but the next level down, the grunt players, the people in the trenches, they make a bunch of money. And by the time they're done, it's all gone. Because nobody taught them what to do or how to do it, or and everybody's got their hand in it. And when the career's over, so many of them we hear about are bankrupt. Is that true?
No. It's true of a certain generation. But these young players are sophisticated. They've seen horror stories. And we introduce them to a financial planner right up front. So they get a budget. They get long-term planning. They understand that the tenuous nature of the tenure of their career.
Absolutely. One injury and it's over.
Yeah. Right. So they get all that, and so the young men who get in trouble are the ones that don't have family or anyone else screening financial planners, or they don't hire one, or they hire one that's not qualified. But the predominant majority of players today are well financially planned, and the dollars are so explosive that
unbelievable contracts, amounts of money that are mind-boggling.
We just had free agency, and no one in the world ever dreamed that Trent McDuffie, a corner for the LA Rams, would sign for $30 million a year. This is a cornerback.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
We understand franchise quarterbacks do something else.
They supposedly carry the whole team, but the cornerback, yeah.
Yeah, and a center signed in free agency for $28 million a year. And now, these were really low-paid positions.
For a long time. And I remember, again, I'm going back to the 60s, being an NFL player in the early, I grew up in the Midwest, the Packers, the Lions, the Vikings, all that kind of stuff. Many of them had to have second jobs on the off season because it didn't pay enough to do this. They didn't make massive amounts of money. It was a passion. It was something they did. Now it's mind-boggling, the amount of money.
So when I started in 75 and then 76, each team, as its share of the national TV contract, got $2 million. Today, they make about $300 million per team per season.
Just off of that contract.
For TV.
Yeah.
The two franchises that came into the league were Tampa Bay and Seattle in 1976. They had a purchase price of $16.5 million.
For the whole team.
Today, the Dallas Cowboys are valued at about $10 or $11 billion.
And what are the Seahawks going to go for when they sell them? Who knows?
Yes.
When Jeff Bezos or whoever's rumored to buy it, somebody's going to buy it from the Paul Allen estate. They won the Super Bowl. Time to sell. And everybody's holding their breath saying, how much?
The old Redskins, now the Commanders, sold for $6.2
billion.
So that would certainly be the floor.
Wow. All right. And I guess I got to say, as a lifelong fan, is too much money too, is that a problem? Is it too, I don't know, money seems to corrupt so many things here. People and personalities in sports. There is so much to be made in these sports. The massive audience has gotten so big there. There has to be a flip side to that, too. Downside.
Remember that we're now in an era where pro football is not only the most popular sport in the country, it's the most popular form of televised entertainment.
Yeah.
Like 40 of the 50 top shows were NFL, and 130 million people watched the Super Bowl.
And I remember the first Super Bowl at the Rose Bowl, I didn't go. But the story was that they didn't sell out.
So that's all gone. And today we have fantasy sports, and
yes,
we have gambling, and we have naming rights and luxury boxes and
yes,
stadia.
And what about this whole idea? I'm sorry to have you here. I have to ask a couple of fan questions. This whole idea of student athletes. Now, should they be compensated? They are being compensated. They're finding unique ways to give them their, what's the new kid for the University of Michigan where I went to school, he got a couple $1 million because he's for his name or naming rights or something, whatever.
No, let me tell you that story.
Okay.
It's Underwood.
Yes, that was something.
And he originally committed to LSU, and they offered him about $4 million in NIL. And
what's NIL?
Name, image, likeness.
There you go.
So what happened is the rules changed, and all of a sudden, undergrads could hire marketing directors, and they could get whatever deals, but it's now the aspect of recruiting. So anyway, Underwood comes to Michigan, and he's offered $14
million. $14
million. And he leaves LSU.
Because LSU doesn't have that kind of deep pocket. They got a big alumni network. It's not the University of Michigan, though. That.
It's the law of unintended consequences.
Right.
They wanted to rectify the fact that some athletes were living below the standard of living of the non-athletic peer.
Yeah, they said it was kind of like a form of indentured slavery or something. You just got to put your time in, and you get nothing for it, and you could get hurt along the way and lose your whole career, but this is how you made it to the pros. This was the system.
Well, the whole system's changed, and now it's high schoolers bidding off colleges against each other, and then when they get to the college, there's something called a transfer portal.
Yeah, when would this whole crazy thing?
They can just leave and go to another school,
yeah,
possibly for more money. So we've got that as a new factor. We have gambling, which is an existential threat to the continuation
of
sport.
I think it is. How many, we just had these NFL athletes, or not NBA athletes, get accused or convicted or whatever of gambling?
So think of this, Paul. The whole industry rests on the concept that these are real athletic contests.
Exactly.
With neutral refereeing, with everyone trying as hard as they can.
It's so not rigged. This isn't the 1911 right. World Sox or Black Sox World Series or something.
If all of a sudden, and you've had this in baseball and you've had it in basketball, if all of a sudden fans start to doubt the integrity of the game and think it's wrestling, not a real contest.
It's scripted.
There we go. And then you have conference realignment, which I went to Cal Berkeley. So when you walk across the campus, you look out at the Pacific Ocean and the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right.
Where Cal's now in a conference called the Atlantic Conference.
The Atlantic Conference, right. With the Pacific Ocean at their back here.
There have been extraordinary changes in
the Big Ten. The Big Ten's absorbed schools all over the nation now here. I don't understand it anymore. Here.
Ten is hardly descriptive.
No, I don't even know what it is. I don't even know how many are in it. All right, so we could talk. Rare opportunity to geek and be a sports fan and from somebody who's watched this evolve over the inside. I want to hear how your career evolved. You were on top. You were the guy. And I don't know why here in Orange County, I wouldn't picture this as the center of giant sports agencies here, but somehow you were here because you were from here. And then somehow didn't go well. It started to fall apart. Talk about those days, a struggle. What happened?
The business didn't fall apart, but what did was my personal life. And I had a situation where over a couple years, my two sons were diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, which is an eye disease that led them both to be blind.
Oh, my God.
And I felt helpless to help them. Then my father, who was a central figure in my life, died a long, sad death of esophageal cancer. And then we lived and we lived in a home in Newport Beach that had mold in it. And we, a lot of the beachside properties have a certain level of mold, but this was toxic. And we had to move out of that home with a day or two notice. And I ended up knocking it to the ground because I didn't want to even sell
it. Yeah.
I didn't want to sell, put that on another person. This all came together and I felt helpless. And I couldn't help my kids. I couldn't help my father. I couldn't put a roof over our head. And I turned to the wrong thing, alcohol. And I had not been a lifelong long drinker. I was
going to say, is that something that ran in your family, or is it something you started early?
No, you don't have to have a genetic background or anything. You can drink your way to alcoholism. And so,
the old-fashioned way, one drink at a time.
And then my marriage started to fall apart. It was the confluence of all those different negative experiences, and I turned to the wrong thing, which was alcohol.
How do you keep working, though, with all this stuff? It's like the Hollywood story. The people are on the surface, they're making movies, they're making millions, they're making all this stuff. And at home, it's just...
Because I was highly functional at work, it's just that because of alcohol, I started missing days and not showing up. And eventually I got to the point where the only cogent thought in my mind was, where can I find more vodka?
Wow.
And so I shut down my business. I moved into my parents' home. There was a certain distance with a couple of my kids. And finally I had an epiphany at one point. And I said, my dad had these two core values: treasure relationships, especially family, and try to make a meaningful difference in the world and heal pain and help people who couldn't help themselves.
What did he do? What was his?
My dad was a high school principal, but his passion was the Human Relations Commission of Los Angeles, and to keep racial peace and the fight against hate. So I had that upbringing. And
a fight we're still fighting today here. I'm sorry.
We are. And my dad used to say something else, Paul. He would say, if you're waiting for someone else to make the change, to pick up the piece of trash or to fight racism, the tendency is to wait for they or them, the amorphous they or them, to solve the problem.
Right.
And he would look at me and say, you could wait forever, son. The they is you.
The they is you, and the you day is now.
You are the they. And
so here you had this, I dare say, the business, the wheels came off, your life, the business, whatever, and many would have thought, I only knew you as a personality. We all thought, gee, that was a great run, but it fell apart. It's over.
I had an epiphany, which was that I wasn't a starving peasant in Somalia. I didn't have the last name Steinberg in Nazi Germany in the 40s.
Right.
I didn't have cancer or heart disease or anything. What excuse did I have not to live up to my father's admonition? So the hardest part of it is breaking denial. Alcohol convinces you don't have the problem. Other people.
Yeah, my late uncle, who I adored, I discovered later in life, was a raging alcoholic, and what saved him was AA. What saved him was AA, and isn't the first tenet of AA to recognize, I got a problem?
It's to understand that you're powerless over alcohol and your life's become unmanageable.
Right.
So once I could break denial, because I was still functional at work, but once I got to the point where I wasn't, then it was all about solution to me. And I found a unique fellowship that you just named.
Friends of Bill.
With a 12-step program, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps, and I just stayed in process, which is everything that anybody suggested as a way to deal with the problem, I did. And I moved into sober living, And and I waited a couple years to make sure that my sobriety was solid. And I knew if I was going to re-enter the field that people would have questions. And I had to be prepared for
real
people
questions.
To
Can
say,
he, you know, didn't he have a problem? And right, is he still okay?
How can you guarantee that you'll stay sober? Yeah. The answer to that
because
is
you're living
you
in a rarefied world that we can only imagine. Massive amounts of money. The most famous athletes in the world must be parties, women's things. I can only imagine. For a brief while, I was a Hollywood. I worked in Hollywood as a press agent for Johnny Mathis and Anthony Quinn, a variety of other people. When I was in my early late 20s, and saw many of them, not those people, but many of them blow up under the excess, the parties, the money. I can do anything. The rules don't apply to me, and eventually they do.
So, as I said, I felt powerless, right. And I've always been pretty good with problems if I got the tools and could be work harder, be more creative, and figure it out.
Sounds like it.
But alcohol rewired my brain.
Yeah.
And
It does that. Alcohol. Yeah.
And
you think differently. It's hard to see the life the same way. Yeah. You
can't see outside. So anyway, after about 3 years, I went down to Houston and I found there were many different people who were willing to fund me to come back and represent. They probably saw me as a distressed property.
That had great growth potentials.
But I got a group, and in 2016, I signed Paxton Lynch, who was a quarterback for Memphis, and he went in the first round of the draft.
And did you have any clients at this point? You're just starting over again?
Just a couple. Yeah. But so that was the first round quarterback that mm-hmm. had been my sort of...
Your calling card.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And then the next year came Patrick Mahomes.
And talk about that for a second, because where in the world did Patrick Mahomes come? I didn't hear, maybe I'm not that insider football here, but it was like Tom Brady when he played for U of M. I follow U of M football passionately. I don't remember Tom Brady's career that much at U of M. He came out, was drafted 50 or 60 years, way, way down the list. Nobody saw the potential there. Was Mahomes like that, or was everybody anticipating him to be what he was?
No, there were doubts because Texas Tech had a really horrendous defense, and so they were giving up 50 points a game. So for him to have a chance to win, he had to throw every pass.
He had to score 60 points.
And there was a thought of him as a gunslinger.
Yeah, that's what I had the image. Right. And gunslingers are like Brett Favre and stuff. They live and die, and they go up and down.
And the truth was that they weren't projecting him for the fact he could adopt to a 3-5-7 step drop and could throw from the pocket and had the most gifted arm I've ever seen.
Again, you're verifying. What little I remember of Patrick Mahomes coming in, I didn't know where he came from or think that he was going to be the guy he turned out to be.
So I always thought that he would be a splendid NFL player. I did not think that after sitting his first year, he would go on to be MVP in his first year starting.
Yeah.
I couldn't have anticipated that sort of growth, but football today is all about the franchise quarterback. And if a team doesn't have one, they have a really faint chance of making the Super Bowl. And let's define that as someone you can build around for 10 to 12 years, someone you can win because of rather than with, and importantly, in critical adversity, throwing a couple interceptions, crowd is booing.
Yeah.
What does he do now?
What does he do next? What does he do?
The same theme of my book, which is, can you compartmentalize? Can you adopt a quiet mind? Can you elevate your level of play in those situations?
And can you be resilient? I've forgotten the gentleman's name. He was a NFL a lineman for the Seattle Seahawks and some others. He lives locally. Big, huge guy. He does some charity work with the Hispanic Chamber and some others on their show. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name. I shouldn't. Big, huge, impressive guy. He played, I don't know, 80s, 90s or something. So he made money, but not millions and millions of dollars type of thing. And his whole core message to kids today is you got to be resilient. Well, you can't fade and fold the first bad thing happens. And my father's there. I grew up in, I'm a child of the 50s and 60s. My father fought the World War II and the Depression. He was everything. Resilient was baked into their DNA. They had to be resilient to survive the greatest generation. Today's generation, how fast do I get there? I've never seen a downturn. I've never seen struggle. So many of these kids, I don't know if resiliency is baked into their DNA like it is, like we thought it was.
No, I think they're addicted to social media.
Yeah.
And social scientists have been very clever in figuring out how to get little squirts of dopamine.
Isn't that the truth?
Every
constantly plugging into your brain. Little shot here, yeah.
You text somebody, they don't text you back, in the next 20 seconds, oh my God, they don't like me.
Yes, exactly.
You post something, you don't get enough likes, oh my God.
And I quit. Or I get a job and I'm not the president the next year. I quit, and I go get another job.
It's because we haven't had to live through much adversity outside of COVID.
And you don't have to work towards it. It either happens. You're going to get it quickly. I'm going to fame overnight, money quickly here. And if it doesn't, if I have to spend 10 years, a franchise quarterback means developing somebody every year. I see NFL teams throwing franchise quarterbacks away. My other big passion, the Minnesota Vikings. What the heck are they going to do with J.J. McCarthy from my alumni? Are they going to give up on the project 1 year in, 2 years in?
They already have.
Sounds like they have.
Because they've got Kyler Murray there.
Yeah. Do we stick with something long enough? Are we willing to ride it out?
No.
Or do we want quick returns, quick results?
The franchises that win in professional sports do have patience and do have a long-term vision. The ones that don't, your Vikings had a quarterback. His name was Sam Darnold, and I believe he just won the Super Bowl for another team.
I think he did, because we couldn't see past. Yeah, I don't know. They thought it was a fluke. They didn't see it. They didn't see the long-term value. All right, so you're in this incredible run-up, dare I say, an incredible fall down. And I'm not trying to, I hope this doesn't offend you, but that's the movie I would see, the rise and the fall. How do you get back up?
Like I said, by being prepared to answer all the questions about your reentry, by putting together a ritual, a everyday protocol that...
That's something else most people don't have. I'm not sure I have a daily ritual. I just do this. My dad used to just get up, put your suit on, do this thing, go forward. Too many of us sit and wonder, wait, worry.
But you have to keep going to meetings. You have to work with your sponsor. You have to work those 12 steps.
Yeah.
And if you do, the cravings eventually fade, and you can get back. And so we just reestablished. I've done a Super Bowl party for 39 years that's got a brain body lounge.
I hear it is the greatest thing. I dream of someday just being a mouse in the corner and trying to get into one of these things.
You can come next year.
You say that. Thank you.
It's in Los Angeles.
I would love to come and just this quietest little corner, and you can stick me in just to sit and watch the fly on the wall.
We give humanitarian awards. We, to an owner, a general manager, for things they do positively. We have a charity. Last year we moved a family into the first home they'll ever own. And so we started that again. And then I've had this passion for about 35 years, which is the danger of athletic concussion.
Yeah, I didn't know if we wanted to go there, but you opened the door. My little grandson loves football. And we're wondering, should he play football? He's 11. He's 12 now.
No. The answer is he shouldn't play it till high school.
Yeah,
because
his brain's still forming.
But I had a crisis of conscience. In the 80s, I'm representing half the starting quarterbacks in the NFL. They keep getting hit in the head. And we would go to neurologists and doctors and ask them how many was too many. And
how many is too many?
They had no answers.
Yeah.
And so I held the first concussion conference in 1994, and we had Troy Aikman and Steve Young and Warren Moon and other folks there. I just wrote a book with two doctors on athletic concussion. So we continue to try to advance the field of treatment and prevention.
Wow. We had Dr. Joseph, now forget his last name. I'm terrible at names as I get older in our hair.
Maroon.
You know the guy. Joseph Maroon. He was with the Steelers. He was there.
Yes.
And he was at a conference here at UCI. And he was talking about his work with, what would you call it, brain injuries and stuff, and getting people to actually get up and walk again and stuff.
The phrase is traumatic brain injury.
That's it. And he had some different ideas and radical things he's been trying, and it's a fascinating conversation here. We had him up here and talking about that, of how it maybe isn't over. It isn't the, who was the guy, the Superman, Christopher Reeves. It maybe isn't the end of the world if you get a spinal cord injury or something here.
We have some new breakthroughs. One's called RTMS, which is magnets against the brain that can, through neuroplasticity, actually rewire a concussed brain, and the other is neurofeedback, so there's hope.
And he was actually talking about some other enzyme. I've forgotten down here, but fast. Go back and look up the interview we did with Dr. Joseph Maroon. Fascinating conversation here. This has been a fascinating conversation. I could say you got a million places to go. I could sit here for 4 hours and talk to you about all these subjects here, about your life, about the inspiration of how you got back up off the mat, dare I say, and back out and active again, and to the highest pinnacle of success, representing not just Patrick Mahomes, but a whole bunch of other people. You said at the talk I heard you give, and I've said this to so many people, I said at the beginning of the show, you didn't doubt you could rebuild the business. Why? I would have doubted my ability to do anything after I built something up and lost it, or had it taken from me, or didn't. I'm not sure I would trust myself or believe in myself to do it again.
Because I had a methodology that allowed us to dominate that field.
Clearly, for years, yeah.
And it still works. What I needed to conquer was alcohol and sobriety. And when my comeback was being a good father for my kids and all the rest of it, the whatever career satisfaction there's been, it's just a cherry on top.
Just a cherry on top. That's the right way to look at it here. For Rennie, that's the only motivation, and the family and the legacy and the community are come a distant second here. I think that was the lesson I always got from my father. Whatever you do in life, be a good person and be good to those around you, and good things will happen. And if they don't, then make it through it. Don't give up. Keep going. That's that World War II generation here. It's been a very great pleasure. Hold up the book. So where can we go get the book? It's called The Comeback. Is it out now everywhere, or has it been out for a while?
No, it's out on the 24th, so it's out next week.
Okay, perfect timing.
You can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon and pre-order it now.
Okay, The Comeback. The amazing story of an amazing gentleman here who had an amazing career, starting with, I met a guy in college. Was it Steve Barkowski? Is that your first client? And he says, hey, kid, why don't you represent me? And you call up the teams and like, what? We don't talk to agents. We talk to the athlete.
In that case, Paul, because I had the first pick and they'd already drafted him, it was deal with me or
deal with nobody.
Or don't sign the player.
Yeah, that was pretty radical, rethinking. And from that, you built a methodology and a formula. You had half, is that what you said? Half of the NFL quarterbacks at one point in the first go-round. And then all that, as you would, so many would think, fame, fortune, lead goes to your head, things blow up, it's the party is too much for to handle. And the problems were overwhelming, it sounds, in your life, personal problems. And when you were able to get back up and come back and do it again, that's the great American story. We all want to see the rise, and we all fear the fall, but we long for the comeback story. We all look for that. So thank you for sharing your comeback story. What an inspiration to all of us here to never give up. To keep going.
And if you're out there and struggling and despondent and depressed and
I've been all of those at different times.
Have lost hope. Yeah. Just know the help's available. You don't have to do this alone.
And yet I had my own dark period where I struggled in depression, anxieties and all those kinds of stuff. And what I found was normally your body tells you what to do. If you burn yourself, I'm not gonna do that again. Don't touch that. Your body will pull back. But when you're feeling dark, depressed, down, whatever, your body just says, hold up, quit, give up. It doesn't give you the right signals. Somehow you have to force yourself to get out and find those answers. I found.
We'll never quit.
That's clear. Thank you for joining us. The great Lee Steinberg. What a pleasure. I told everybody I was so excited that you're going to come in and do this thing here today. Again, the book is The Comeback. It's coming out right now, and it should be on everybody's shelf. Thank you so much for joining us here. And I'm going to hold you to that. I want to be, make me the janitor or something. I'll be in the back of the room for your Super Bowl thing. I want to see one of these things.
Oh,
these
I think we can handle you being a regular
slip in
guest.
Somewhere here?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I look forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us here on this conversation. What an incredible tale, and it ain't over yet. Thanks for joining us here.
You're welcome.
There you have it. What an incredible tale. Sorry, I got caught up in it here. We could go on for hours. That's why we do these shows. OC Spotlight, showing the most incredible people doing the most amazing things right here in your backyards. If they can do it, you can do it. And we hope that you'll share this with somebody and so maybe give them a little bright hope. As we continue to showcase all sorts of OC stories from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beale Applied Innovation Center.